From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
With 3 weeks to go until the crucial Pennsylvania primary, polls show that Hillary Clinton's lead over Barack Obama is shrinking.
But with 158 delegates at stake, both candidates realize it is key to win the Keystone State.
Now, the last time the Democrats had a big fight on their hands really was 1968.
Yeah, it sure is a close and exciting race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Barack Obama's lead over Hillary Clinton is, in fact, so small that he cannot lock up enough pledged delegates to guarantee victory before the August convention. And with the Pennsylvania primary approaching, the media have followed every campaign twist and turn. The New York Times, Obama's support softens in poll. Reuters, Clinton leads Obama-McCain in key matchups. The Wall Street Journal, Indiana marks the next test for Clinton. And here's NBC's Brian Williams.
There are 10 more contests to go before there are no more for the Democrats. And sooner or later, there will be a Democratic nominee. For now, though, it's a two-way race.
Two-way race? Well, yes and no. Like the Mideast peace process and the Kansas City Royals, Senator Clinton technically has a chance to prevail, but that would take something of a miracle. Chris Beam is a political reporter for Slate, where he is the main contributor to the Trailhead and Hillary Death Watch blogs. I asked him what percentage of the remaining popular vote Clinton would need to catch up to Obama.
I would put the number somewhere around 60%. If you look at how she did in Ohio, she won with 55% of the vote and ended up netting 300,000 votes. So it is possible to score big victories, but the problem is they all have to be big for her to make up that number.
Not only big, but historically big.
Right. And given the way that this race has gone so far, the likelihood of her winning the next 8 contests by that margin is next to impossible.
Is there any chance that delegates from the Florida and Michigan primaries will be counted at the convention?
They're pretty much guaranteed to be seated right now. They will attend. But it depends what you mean by count. If they're able to allocate the delegates proportionally and say in Florida to give Hillary the delegates that she won based on the results of that election, then yeah, that could help her. But right now, I think that's pretty much hit a roadblock.
What are the chances of her amassing more pledged delegates than Obama between now and the convention?
The odds of that are zero, barring the meteor scenario. If there's some revelation akin to Jeremiah Wright, but 10 times worse, something that Obama isn't able to survive, then the pledged delegate count won't matter as much.
Now, when you're talking about a meteor, you're talking about a video of Barack Obama in a motel room with a den of Cub Scouts setting fire to the American flag.
He has to be client number 8, pretty much.
So, to recap, to persuade so-called superdelegates to discount the pledged delegate count and support her, Clinton needs some combination of an aggregate landslide margin in the 10 remaining primaries, a disqualifying bombshell about her opponent, and winner-take-all revotes in Florida and Michigan, which both states have said will not occur. True enough, careful readers of campaign coverage know this. It has been duly reported. But does the totality of the coverage, especially the breathless stride-by-stride call of the horse race, distort the political reality? Understanding that even posing this question exposes us to accusations of partisanship, we nonetheless feel obliged to ask why, after prematurely burying McCain before Iowa, Clinton after Iowa, and Obama after New Hampshire, are the media suddenly so unjudgmental? With actual vote counts in hand instead of mere poll results and punditry, why contribute to a sense of drama and suspense when, barring a bizarre convergence of improbabilities, the race is all over but the shouting? So, once again, apologies to Clinton faithful for the question, but at least it's not a rhetorical one. Political blogger Mark Ambinder, an associate editor of The Atlantic, insists that probabilities or no probabilities, it's not over till it's over.
It is unlikely that she finds a way to win the Democratic nomination. It is not impossible. The manner by which Barack Obama wins the Democratic nomination is unknown at this point. For example, the mass of superdelegates, those who can actually tangibly end this thing once and for all, have yet to do so. party elders like Harry Reid, Howard Dean have set a date of July 1st. So it's hard to come up with a conclusion, as some journalists I know have done, that the press should simply stop covering Hillary Clinton, should anoint Barack Obama the nominee, and plunge head-on into the general election.
But isn't there a middle road, not coronating Obama and relegating Hillary Clinton to, you know, the dustbin of political history, but to put the same kind of context in the play of coverage as it puts into the stories themselves, which is to say, pay less attention to the back and forth of a campaign that, you know, is fundamentally over, and cover the remaining contests with the appropriate emphasis, you know, even if it has to be on the inside pages?
I think it's a truism that given X to cover, the media is going to cover it as a horse race. But I think, you know, major network evening newscasts have, in their pieces, pointed out that Barack Obama is likely to win the nomination because of his delegate leads, and it'll be challenging for Hillary Clinton. Major newspaper articles have done the same thing. There is one holdout to this, and that is, of course, the cable news networks. They are the medium that I think is financially profiting from a prolonged race. They're probably the only medium that is financially profiting from an extended race, because if you talk to producers and budget planners at the television networks, they would tell you that they're losing money because of the need to continually supply satellite trucks and personnel to cover two candidates. There are very few newspapers that have a full-time person covering John McCain. All of that is to say that I think people see how cable news networks cover the story. They impart that coverage to the rest of the media, which I think is being a bit more responsible.
But I continue to be struck by the totality of the coverage that suggests that the race is a race, and that something other than a defection by superdelegates of historic significance could change the way it turns out.
Half the party, if you include Florida and Michigan votes, at this point is not fully on board with Barack Obama. And that's another reality that I think is reflected in the uncertainty about the state of the race. I don't know how or why that reality isn't as important as Hillary Clinton's minuscule chance of winning the nomination.
I just wonder, if Americans were polled not about who they want to see as the Democratic nominee, but polled about their understanding of the race, whether it would reveal a misimpression.
That's a good question, but I'm not so sure that if there's a belief, perseverance, I guess is what psychologists would call it, among voters that there's a race, is something that we could point to as evidence that the media isn't doing its job.
All right, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Mark Ambinder covers politics for The Atlantic. David Chalian is political director for ABC News. He also believes it is for the Democratic Party, not the press, to call the fight, and the press's job to document the blow-by-blow till that happens.
The pledged delegate lead, though significant, that Senator Obama has, is still rather close. And the key factor here is that neither one of them can get to that magic number until the superdelegates make their mind up. As long as that's the case, this is a race.
Now, you don't sit in a staff meeting every morning with your reporters and producers going, how do we keep this story alive? There's nothing in it for you, per se, to overcover a thin story, is there?
Well, I don't think that anybody has ever said that politics is the thing that drives ratings or newspaper sales through the roof. I don't think that's ever been the case. So, no, I don't think there's really something in it necessarily for us. I do think that we have seen in this election cycle an unprecedented level of interest. We see it in our polling. We see it in voting registration statistics and turnout for the events. And clearly, I think there has been an uptick in sort of online political reading, if you will. So there is a very engaged electorate. But I don't think we have ever felt challenged that we somehow had to keep the story alive. This story seems to be keeping itself alive quite well.
Let me run this bit of pop psychology by you. The media were so burned by prematurely burying the McCain campaign, by burying Hillary Clinton after Iowa, by resurrecting her after New Hampshire, and so on, that we as an institution are just sitting on our hands for fear of saying anything that would smack of analysis that could come back to haunt us.
There's no doubt that the McCain lesson, the New Hampshire lesson, has just caused us to take a step back for a moment and say, sometimes things can happen and we have to allow for that. I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing, that we sometimes hold back in our definitive analysis before all the final facts are in.
What about pure cynicism, the idea that the press imagines that the Clinton campaign has another weapon that it's just waiting to unleash that could be the political bombshell that does dislodge the superdelegates and bring them into the Clinton camp?
I don't think that we are at the stage of the campaign that either campaign can hold too much in their arsenal. Now, there is no doubt they know that their only path to the nomination is to buy Senator Clinton more time to allow for the possibility that more information will be put out there that will demonstrate to superdelegates that Barack Obama is going to have a tough time in a general election. If they can't make that argument, she's not going to be the nominee.
If you will for a moment buy my premise that the race is fundamentally over, are the media not aiding and abetting the Clinton campaign's strategy to buy time by keeping the appearance of a contest alive?
If the Clinton campaign had no reasonable argument to make to these undecided superdelegates, there would be nothing to stop them rallying around Barack Obama right now. Everything is in place to do so. There is clearly a reason these uncommitted superdelegates are still willing to watch what voters in upcoming states do and to hear Hillary Clinton and her team out on an argument about Barack Obama's electability. If that was an absurd argument on its face, I think it would actually fundamentally be over. We're just not quite there yet.
Well, David, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
David Chalian is political director of ABC News.
Coming up, political vandals deface the Wikipedia pages of Clinton and Obama, and what that says about their chances. Also, how to live in a post-fact society.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The current fascination with the race for the Democratic nomination is by no means limited to journalism's elite. USA Today noted recently that battles over the candidates are popping up wherever people gather. Facebook, MySpace, YouTube, even the hugely popular online fantasy game World of Warcraft. But the dragon slayers of World of Warcraft are pikers compared to the mischief makers of Wikipedia. Eve Fairbanks has just written about the Wiki War in The New Republic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Eve, what really are the stakes here? I mean, does it really matter if the Wikipedia entries for Clinton and Obama are right or wrong?
For each candidate, their Wikipedia page is the second Google hit after their official campaign page. So they're pretty much the second source of information that someone on the internet would go to find out about the candidate. The thing about Wikipedia is almost every page anyone can edit, no matter who you are, anonymous, whatever. So you can just vandalize it. You can replace the entire page with profanity. Basically, this encyclopedia that huge numbers of people use is relying on these candidates' own fans or people who monitor those pages to fix that.
Who gets slammed harder, Obama or Clinton?
They get slammed hard, both of them, but in different ways. Hillary seems to be the target of a sort of primal loathing. Her page is vandalized more than Obama's, by which I mean the entire thing is replaced with a picture of a middle finger or anti-female profanity. Obama's is the target of, I would say, almost more intelligent attacks from indignant people who feel like he's gotten a free pass in the media. And so they're trying to put in a lot of stuff about his pastor, Reverend Wright, or get in a lot of stuff about the Muslim ties in his family, his stepfather, who was a Muslim in Indonesia. So it's more substantive.
And if these vandals are unseen, they're also unsung heroes. These are the people who wearily troll these sites, fixing and restoring the truth, only to see the lives and invective come rolling back like a wave. Kevin Bailey, a.k.a. Bellwether, is the guy who patrols Obama's page. Tell me about him.
He's just one of a kind of group of people who patrol Obama's page. He's a teacher from North Carolina, very sweet guy who is a fan of Obama. Notice, you know, the forces of darkness trying to put in these agendas about Obama. He was telling me he used to get up early in the morning and go right to the page and check it to see what mischief had taken place overnight. So he was really active, just thousands of edits in a space of months on that page for a while. And I think it started to overwhelm him.
It's hard to imagine what set of criteria he applies to changes that he monitors as a volunteer. He is shaping the biography of Barack Obama on this page just as much as the vandals are. And why should we trust him anymore?
There's a kind of culture on Wikipedia which is called POV. You're not supposed to be POV. That means point of view. These entries are supposed to be neutral. And you can make a stronger argument that something, a phrase that seems critical about one of the candidates is POV. That can be more easily wiped from their Wikipedia page than something like, Obama was the first black head of the Harvard Law Review. And so you just get these Wikipedia pages over time that get packed with all this positive stuff. They almost do read a little bit like campaign documents. And there's a guy who has shaped Hillary's page to a huge extent, and he's a Hillary voter, but he does express some frustration that it's hard for him to get stuff on there that speaks more to her role in the American culture, how polarizing she's been, just because somebody's going to come along and say, oh, that's not fair to Hillary. It shouldn't be in Wikipedia.
Let's talk about that guy. I think you're referring to Jonathan Schilling, right?
Uh-huh.
A software developer from New Jersey. And part of the problem for him is that although he is a Hillary supporter, he's not the kind of passionate supporter that sits there every second watching the site change.
It was interesting when I was looking at Hillary's page. You can look back at all the changes that were made, the history. And in January and February, the arguments were so intense, and even Schilling was getting some pushback. People said, oh, I can tell you're an Obama fan. You're trying to include this stuff about her low fundraising numbers. You're just trying to doom Hillary. And the funny thing was that he told me, you know, I voted for Hillary on Super Tuesday. I think she'd make a great commander-in-chief, but I don't think she's God. But in recent days, I think you do notice that Hillary's page, it has kind of the air of a neighborhood that's degentrifying. People are losing interest. Schilling, the guy who watches the Hillary page, he noted that right when Rudy Giuliani, his candidacy, started to go into decline, so did his Wikipedia page.
In fact, you tried a little experiment, didn't you? You introduced material into each of those pages.
I said that Hillary, even with superdelegates, didn't have much of a chance anymore, and I wrote that Obama was starting to lose some white support in recent primaries like Mississippi. And on Hillary's page, it sat there for something like 4 hours, but somebody came onto the Obama page, I think in under 3 minutes, protested my edit and just removed it. You know, not relevant.
Eve, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Eve Fairbanks is the associate editor of The New Republic. For nearly 2 years, David Marish has been the senior Washington anchor of Al Jazeera English. Launched in 2006, the channel boasted broadcasting centers in Doha, Kuala Lumpur, London, and Washington, D.C., and bureaus worldwide. Marish was one of Al Jazeera's most prestigious hires, bringing years of experience as a Nightline correspondent. We spoke to him shortly before he took the job, and he said that the news channel, the brainchild of the Emir of Qatar, had no particular political axe to grind.
Al Jazeera is almost perfectly clear of any national interest or any dictated political policy.
No longer. Last week, David Marish announced he was leaving Al Jazeera English, citing anti-American bias and too much control exerted from Al Jazeera headquarters in Doha. He said the editorial climate began to change last year after the American vice president visited the region.
When Dick Cheney was in the Gulf bracing America's allies for possible action against Iran, the Gulf states essentially told Cheney that this was a terrible idea and not one that they were prepared to support in any way. And from that point forward, started moving in ways that were dramatically independent of American foreign policy. Also around that time, Qatar started to make up its long-standing differences with Saudi Arabia, and Al Jazeera English started to slide away from its original goal of being a literally cosmopolitan channel of all the world viewed from all the world's viewpoints to something closer to Al Jazeera Arabic, which is a terrific, straight-up news organization, but one which reports from the point of view and to the interests of a world basically defined by the Arabic language, the Islamic religion, and the Middle Eastern regional interest.
You cited anti-American bias in your decision to leave Al Jazeera, but you also told us that the reporters that were covering your departure have distorted the meaning of anti-American bias. I don't quite follow.
What I ought to do is simply define for you what I mean by anti-American bias. Everywhere else in the world, most notably Latin America and Africa and the Middle East, Al Jazeera's bureaus are manned by people from the region that they are covering. They are covered with real authenticity and insight. And, you know, our two American reporters were able to bring that insight. But a lot of the people, the majority, who were brought in simply did not know America well enough and didn't have the time to learn it fast enough before they were on the air putting on reports that seemed to me to be tendentious or shallow. Everybody else's elections have been covered by teams from the region. Super Tuesday was covered by a team that was largely sent from Doha.
Why do you think Al Jazeera is skimping on resources for U.S. coverage? Is it simply because the U.S. audience is so small, or is there another reason?
I think it's true that part of the reason is that Al Jazeera English's American audience is almost exclusively limited to the Internet, which may make it of less importance to them, although nobody has ever copped to that to me. But it's also true that I think there is a resentment and anger against America that is out there in the world. And I think that a kind of condescending, specifically English resentment and anger at the United States does work itself out in editorial decisions being made by the channel.
What do you mean English resentment? You mean from the Brits working at Al Jazeera?
Exactly. 1776, terrible mistake. Let us teach you the error of your ways.
Was there a particular incident at Al Jazeera that clinched your decision to leave?
A proposed job change got me thinking about it seriously.
What was that?
To stop anchoring and simply become a full-time correspondent.
Was that a demotion?
They said no, but I know better, of course.
Is Al Jazeera any worse in its coverage of the United States than most American television networks are in their coverage of the Middle East?
That's a fair point, Brooke. In many ways, Al Jazeera's coverage of the United States is similar to CNN's coverage of Israel or Saudi Arabia, which is to say that it's very much crisis-driven and shy on nuance and real depth of knowledge. So by conventional standards, it's no worse. But by the standards that I signed up to do and my expectations and what I put my mug and name and reputation out there for Al Jazeera for was something more than that.
David, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
David Marish is the former senior Washington anchor of Al Jazeera English. He started work on a book about the global competition for political and cultural influence through television news. course of things, we expect information to lead to belief. But increasingly, belief precedes information. It is, in fact, immune to information. In the new book, True Enough, Learning to Live in a Post-Fact Society, Farhad Manju traces the evolution of our tendency to tune out facts that don't jibe with our beliefs. He begins with a study conducted in the late 60s. Psychologists put college students in a room to listen to various speeches that were obscured by static. At any point, the test subjects could press a button to temporarily reduce the static. Farhad Manju says that non-smokers would repeatedly reduce the static during speeches about the bad effects of smoking.
The smokers, on the other hand, wanted to only listen to the stuff that confirmed their belief that smoking wasn't so bad for you. It was sort of one of the first and really one of the most clear-cut experiments on selective exposure. It's this psychological concept that basically says we tend to seek out information that comports with our beliefs, and we avoid information that is dissonant, that kind of contradicts our views.
And when your beliefs are not borne out by the facts, and you can't tune the facts out, you can engage in something else, which you call selective interpretation. And that's what a doomsday cult did in 1954 when the world didn't end on schedule.
Right. When the world didn't end on schedule for this group, they decided that, well, maybe the message that they had been getting from this divine prophet actually suggested that their work to prevent the apocalypse worked. So a selective interpretation means you see a set of facts and you fit the interpretation to your beliefs.
Now, you use examples from, you know, decades ago to illustrate selective exposure and selective interpretation, but you contend in your book that these are really manifestations of the current media world of blogs and talk radio and email.
Yeah. And in this world, there is the front door, the big newspapers and big network news outlets. The side doors are the blogs, talk radio, cable news, which actually draws a very small audience. These side doors allow us to kind of amplify these factors of selective exposure and selective interpretation, and they make these factors kind of more important today than they were in the past. Because in the past, you couldn't really seek out media that comported with your beliefs because, well, there weren't that many media choices.
And you give a couple of great examples of how this plays out in the modern media world. The Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, which worked very hard to change the nation's understanding of John Kerry's war record.
Right. They went through this very circuitous path. They held a press conference. Big newspapers and big network news outlets came. And everyone ignored what they had to say because it was apparent to these journalists that the evidence that this group had didn't really stand up. So they went to basically every talk radio outlet in the country, and they popularized their message on the web. And they started to attract donors, which was pivotal for them because then they could run TV ads, and those TV ads then sort of got amplified through the cable news and then eventually made it to, you know, network news. And lots of newspapers and legitimate journalistic outfits ran dozens of pieces basically debunking the Swift Boat Veterans. But the people on the right and to some extent people in the center who listened to people on the right didn't have much exposure to those facts.
Now, you show how false facts on both the right and the left make their way through partisan echo chambers, but you do suggest that conservatives have a different relationship with their media.
Right. People have studied how conservative blogs, for instance, link to each other and how liberal blogs link to each other. And they found that the people on the right generally have a tighter network and are more likely to indulge in only those sources. And this has been a longstanding pattern where psychologists have noticed that people on the right are more efficient at filtering out things that kind of don't really support their views.
We all know it's really easy to manipulate audio, video, and especially with Photoshop, digital images. But it was interesting you said that the biggest effect of the Photoshopification of our society is not that it's easier to fool people, but that now they have even more reason not to believe the evidence of their eyes and ears if they don't want to.
If you live in a world where everything is possibly fake, where every photo you see could have been photoshopped, it gives you license to dismiss that photo. This is true not only of photos, but of basically all kind of documentary evidence that comes at us these days. We can always assume that there's been some digital foul play there and that it's possibly not the truth.
How do we have an informed society if you can disbelieve anything you aren't likely to approve of?
Well, in a number of areas, I argue that we don't have an informed society. That one of the problems of this age is that we have people disagreeing over things that in the past I don't think they would have disagreed about, over the basic science behind global warming, for example, where you have huge numbers of Americans who simply dismiss the science. And one of the difficulties about this situation is that the whole system sort of operates unconsciously. You can't really tell people that your truth is not true. They're not going to believe you. It's possible with the internet to go out and search for the well-researched, documented truth of a situation. It's more possible now than it was ever before. I suppose I can suggest that people try to do that, but I don't know how well that's going to work.
They could have done that all along. It just feels good to listen to the information that supports what we already want to believe. How do you fight something that feels so good?
Well, I suppose just say no.
Farhad, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Farhad Manjoo is author of True Enough, Learning to Live in a Post-Fact Society.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Under Canadian law, freedom of the press is a fundamental right, but not an absolute one. The Canadian Human Rights Act is also part of the law, and it protects individuals or groups from, quote, hatred or contempt. There's even a definition for hatred. It's a feeling of extreme ill will that allows for no redeeming qualities of a person or persons. Late last year, a group of four Muslim Canadians filed a human rights complaint under the act against one of Canada's leading news magazines, Maclean's. At issue, a 2006 piece by conservative columnist Mark Stein, which argued essentially that Muslims are multiplying rapidly and will defeat anyone standing in their path on the way to world domination. It could be described as alarmist or even offensive, but should that matter? Shouldn't a magazine be free from government interference even if some people are offended? The issue has sparked quite a controversy in Canada over press freedom. Nassim Mithwani is one of the students who filed the complaint. She says the theme of Stein's piece, which was called The Future Belongs to Islam, exposed her to hatred and contempt.
The theme of the article being that, in general, we need to be scared of Muslims in the West because Muslims in the West are multiplying like mosquitoes, and that we wish to overtake Western societies in what will essentially be a bloody civil warfare and subject any Westerners that come within our range, basically, to oppression.
Before you filed your complaint, you tried to persuade Maclean's to let you rebut the Mark Stein piece. Tell me how that played out.
Before we actually met with Maclean's, we wanted to do some research into the editorial content of Maclean's magazine to see if this was essentially one article or one in the series of many. What we found was, within 2 years, Maclean's published 19 very lengthy articles, all which in some way, shape, or form allege that Muslims are to be viewed as the enemy. We felt that it was time for the Muslim population to play a part in the discussion about Islam and Muslims that Maclean's had started. We therefore went to Maclean's editors. We asked that a mutually acceptable author, so not us because we're not writers, but somebody that we could both agree upon, would be allowed to author a response to the Stein article. We were told that Maclean's would rather go bankrupt than allow for any response, and that's what really spurred the human rights complaints.
This is all very difficult for Americans to process because we have the First Amendment, which is near absolute. And the idea of government intervening in matters of free expression strikes us as unnatural.
There's two unique features about our charter, which contains our freedom of expression, that I don't believe you would have in your constitution. The first being that our rights and freedoms are explicitly subject to reasonable limits, reasonable within a free and democratic society. Secondly, our rights and freedoms are to be interpreted in light of a multicultural society and to further that feature of our society. So we have basically recognized that there are other rights and values that can sometimes, in reasonable circumstances, trump freedom of expression.
Now, I can tell you categorically that if anyone came in who had a complaint with something that we at On the Media had done, mm-hmm. and the person began to dictate exactly what it is we will do to redress the wrong, we would smile and show them the door. Because even more important than the specifics of what we do in any given story, we are impelled to protect the sanctity of our editorial independence. You understand that principle, no?
I think it's been misrepresented in that we had a demand, and if it wasn't met, we were going to start legal action. We had a proposal that we were hoping we could both compromise on it. Essentially, I don't think that publishing a rebuttal article is an excessive demand. We have not named Mark Stein as a party to the complaint. We've not asked for retraction. We've not asked for an apology from McLean's. What we asked for was that the community that's being under attack have the chance to respond. And I'd also like to add that in Canada, we have what are called press councils. It's a regulatory body in the same way that lawyers and doctors are subject to regulatory bodies. McLean's does not subscribe to a press council. Subscription is voluntary in Canada, nor does it provide an ombudsperson to hear complaints. So essentially, there is no recourse for even factual inaccuracies in their material.
For a moment, let's agree that the piece is not only inflammatory, but fundamentally fascistic. Let's start with that as a premise.
Okay.
Before you filed the petition, did you consider that you would be seen as intolerant of other views? And worse than that, by using the tools of Canada's liberal democracy to stifle dissent, mm-hmm. that you were, in fact, realizing his very predictions, which is that Islam was, is going to use the very tools of our society to take control over us all.
I actually, that possibility never crossed my mind because I don't see myself as separate from Western society. I see myself as a Muslim living in the West and therefore entitled to the legal recourse that any Westerner is entitled to. It's sort of a catch-22. When Muslims feel aggrieved and they resort to tactics such as violence, we criticize it, rightfully so. When Muslims in the West try to use civilized legal recourse, we are also told that somehow this is incompatible with Western values. And to me, that's incomprehensible. I don't understand what we can do.
Nassim, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nassim Mithiwani is a recent graduate of Osgoode Hall Law School. She joined us from London, Ontario. McLean's declined an interview, but Editor-in-Chief Kenneth White made this statement last December. Quote, "The student lawyers in question came to us 5 months after the story ran. They asked for an opportunity to respond. We said that we had already run many responses to the article in our letters section, but that we would consider a reasonable request. They wanted a 5-page article written by an author of their choice to run without any editing by us except for spelling and grammar. They also wanted to place their response on the cover and to art direct it themselves. We told them we didn't consider that a reasonable request for response. When they insisted, I told them I would rather go bankrupt than let someone from outside of our operations dictate the content of the magazine. I still feel that way."
And now, an update on a subject we've been following for a while, America's image abroad. For the first time in years, our standing has actually improved. According to the BBC and Global Scan, a whopping 35% of those surveyed across 34 countries say the U.S. is a positive influence. We can only guess the cause for the slight uptick from last year's 31%, changing perceptions of the war in Iraq, the presidential primary, anger simply bottoming out, a wide margin of error. One thing seems clear. The Bush administration's international PR campaign didn't help too much. Opinion of the U.S. reached its lowest point in 2007, the year in which Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy Karen Hughes stepped down. But PR campaigns by countries shouldn't be written off wholesale. Those with a favorable view of Russia went from 29% last year up to 37% in the most recent poll. That leap in popularity coincides with a huge investment in the agency responsible for Russia's image abroad. Tens of millions of dollars were poured into their public diplomacy campaign, involving a technologically savvy team of some 300 journalists. Of course, there's no way to know how much international opinion is swayed by policy and how much by branding. But if America's approval rating means anything, it's that we have a lot to learn.
This weekend marks the anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. That is, 14 years ago, a plane carrying the president of Rwanda was shot down, sparking a 100-day slaughter of Tutsis and moderate Hutus. Tutsi rebels ended the slaughter and pushed the genocide's perpetrators, an extremist group of Hutus, into neighboring Congo. And that's where many of them have been ever since. Today, the remnants of the genocidal forces are known as the FDLR, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. The FDLR live like parasites among the Congolese. They are a source of strife that has cost 5 million lives.
For years, Rwanda's Tutsi government has used proxy rebel groups in Congo to hunt them down. But over the last few months, with the support of the UN, the two countries have agreed on a plan to bring the Hutu rebels back to Rwanda. It can be summed up like this: lay down your weapons and go home, or be killed. But how do you get thousands of armed men hiding in the forest to return to a country they haven't seen in more than a decade? A radio show, of course. Michael Cavanaugh reports from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
It's 5 o'clock in the morning on a mountaintop, deep in the Congolese bush. If the sun was up, you'd see the village of Kanyabayanga tucked into the hillside to the east. To the west and north and south, all you'd see is forest. And that's where they live.
1 kilometer from here, if you keep going into the forest, in about 30 kilometers, you'd come to the main hideout where the FDLR have been for years and years.
Michel Sibelindire is a Congolese radio host employed by the UN to get the FDLR to return home. Michel struggles to start his generator. There's no electricity in this part of Congo. In fact, there's not much of anything here except for a small contingent of UN soldiers and Michel's shack on top of a mountain. The location is strategic. His mobile transmitter is pointed directly at the forest where the FDLR live, a place where most other radio signals don't reach. On air, Michel calls himself Mike India, after the first letters of his name in the phonetic alphabet, the one that goes Alpha, Bravo, Charlie. All day long, he plays music, everything from Rwandan and Congolese classics to American country music. And in between songs, he speaks directly to the rebels in the bush. Although few of the FDLR actually participated in the 1994 genocide, most were too young at the time, they still threatened to overthrow Rwanda's Tutsi government. Here in Congo, they prey on the local population.
Il fait des viols, vol, il tue les gens.
They rape, they steal, they kill. But I'm working to win these guys over so they can say, Mike India, he's a good guy. He knows our problems.
His message is twofold. First, he tells the rebels that Rwanda is now at peace and it's safe for them there. Then he explains the demobilization package if they return, money, job training, and other basic support to help them reintegrate. It's a message of reconciliation. Most FDLR say they have to hide from their commanders to listen. And then they call.
Hello?
Mike India's cell phone holds the numbers of hundreds of FDLR. This time it's an FDLR captain.
You know the reason why we're fighting, right?
No, I don't know.
If you go to Rwanda, you'll see the reality.
Really? What's the reality?
Although Mike India broadcasts alone, in fact, he sleeps in the shack with his radio, he's far from a one-man show. The UN has three other journalists, like Mike India, in eastern Congo, broadcasting with mobile transmitters directed at the FDLR. Philip Lancaster is the head of the demobilization program for the UN in Congo.
All of them have one aim, and that's to get the message across that the war is over, it's time to stop fighting, it's time to go home and sort out the problems of the past, to find a way to become useful Rwandan citizens again.
A UN plane flies over the main demobilization camp in eastern Congo. From the camp, you can see Rwanda's hills just across Lake Kivu. Before the war, this place was paradise. Mobutu Sese Seko, Congo's infamous dictator, had a vacation home on this lake. Now, this is where the FDLR come, just before they return home. In a large, humid tent at the camp, Dasaroni Zaitan sits and waits for the truck that will take him back to Rwanda. He joined the FDLR 10 years ago. He was 8 years old. Unprompted, Dasaroni takes off his shirt. He was an FDLR porter, and his shoulders are calloused and hard from carrying packs twice as big as his body. He has a knot of flesh on both sides of his left hand. It's a scar from a bullet wound. His mother was killed by a stray bullet. His father was also in the FDLR and died in a firefight in 2002. Dasaroni wouldn't say if his father had participated in the genocide, but the family did come to Congo as refugees in 1994. A few days ago, after 14 years in the bush, he decided to leave.
While we were marching, I told my commanders I was going to collect firewood, and then I ran.
Dasaroni knew if he could sneak away from his FDLR commander and get to the UN forces, he'd be safe. He knew because he heard it on the radio.
After hearing the radio show Guta Huka, I lost all will to stay with the FDLR. Hearing the show made me decide once and for all to go home.
Guta Huka is the main radio show broadcast by the UN on the mobile transmitters like the one Mike India uses. Antoine Samari is one of Guta Huka's producers. Guta Huka means return in Kinyarwanda, the language of the FDLR. The show airs messages from the UN and the governments of Congo and Rwanda. It also broadcasts testimonials from family members of FDLR and from the ex-FDLR who now live in Rwanda. Today, Antoine is putting the finishing touches on the testimony of a former FDLR soldier who recorded a song for his former brothers in arms. In the final version, it's a 3-minute a cappella piece about the cooperative he works with in Rwanda with other ex-combatants. In this part, he sings, "Colonels who are out there, corporals and generals who are out there, come back, help develop our country." These personal appeals have proved the most successful at convincing the FDLR to leave the bush.
In ones and twos.
The UN's Philip Lancaster.
We have a steady trickle of people coming out. The total is now nearly 5,000. We think there are another 6,000 or 7,000 left.
But for those 6,000 or 7,000, their time is up. In mid-March, the UN Security Council resolved to disarm the FDLR, and the UN force in Congo, the largest in the world, is grimly preparing for war. Privately, many in the UN admit that, despite a recent peace accord, the war in Congo is far from over. At the demobilization camp, Antoine Samari finishes mixing this week's edition of Guta Huka. For the past 3 years, he always ends the show with a message of peace. Now, he includes a warning. Over the sound of a Rwandan boy playing a homemade single-string violin, Antoine announces to the FDLR, "The UN is waiting to help you return to Rwanda safely and with dignity. before it's too late. For On the Media, I'm Michael Cavanaugh.
Michael Cavanaugh's report from Congo was funded by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac, Zach Marsh, and Rob Christensen. We also had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.